reflecting,
connecting,
stories,
sound, here on RN. And good morning, Natasha Mitchell with you for Life Matters. Welcome indeed. The big news overnight, Pope Benedict has resigned. The first pope in 600 years to do so. Tune into the Religion and Ethics report this week and, of course, head to the ABC's Religion and Ethics website for more analysis throughout the week on RN. Twitter seems to be serving up quite a spread in response to, I've noticed. Look, on the show later, brekkie cereals, oodles on the supermarket shelves. Beyond the fancy packaging, though, is any of it actually good for us? What to look for? That's our purely practical segment. Also, get on your dancing shoes. 1 billion rising is on its way. Get straight into it because we want your calls on this one this morning. Currently, if you're a parent or carer of little children or a child under 18 with a disability, you can make a request of your boss for flexible working arrangements. This is one of 10 entitlements you have under the National Employment Standards. Well, now the government wants to extend that right to request to more of us. If you have caring responsibilities, or if you're over 55, or if you're experiencing domestic violence, that's an interesting addition, I think. This wouldn't be an automatic entitlement. Employers can refuse a request on, as the wording goes, reasonable business grounds. What are they, we wonder? And there's no mechanism either for a formal appeal by employees of their employer's choice. Here's what Peter Strong, head of the Council of Small Business of Australia, said to Waleed Ali on RN Drive last night.
The right's always been there. Like, the right to ask for it was there before they made it compulsory. I think we need to find out if there's a market failure. I don't think there is. I've never really heard of anybody complaining in a strong way about not being able to get part-time or work or change their rosters around their issues, because in most small businesses, they know why. They say, yeah, well, it did prove difficult to happen. And in most small businesses, they work their way through it. Yeah, so we need to know if there's a market failure. Is in small businesses, are people struggling to get part-time
work? Well, you know, but the question's about accountability. Do you think there should be accountability on employers, particularly of small business, for the decisions they make knocking back requests like this?
Well, there is accountability. People leave if you do it.
Right,
and the person says, I can't work with you anymore, they'll leave and go somewhere else. And, you know, the unemployment rate isn't that high that we can't control that.
Okay, that's Peter Strong, head of the Council of Small Business of Australia, last night on RN Drive. Have you requested flexible hours and been knocked back? Should there be a right of appeal on this one? Or have you made a request and it's worked out for you? How has it worked out? Let us know. And if you're an employer, we want to hear from you too. How have you negotiated requests from your staff for flexible working arrangements? What are the things you really need to consider as someone running a business or a workplace? Do you have concerns about the opening up of this right to request to more people? Will it make your business tricky to manage? We want to hear from both of you today. The number to call, 1300 225 76, or 1300 call RN. That's 1300 225 76. We also have the text message, 0418 226 576. That's 0418 226 576. And if time zones get in the way, 0283 1430. Range of responses coming in on our Facebook page on this one. And joining us this morning is James Thompson. He's editor of BRW, that's Business Review Weekly. He's former editor of Smart Company, an online news site for small and medium business. Welcome, James.
Hi, how are you?
Very well indeed. Marion Baird is also with us. She's Professor of Employment Relations in the Business School at the University of Sydney. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Natasha.
Marion, the extension of these provisions to other categories of workers, not just parents with young children or parents with a child with a disability, is that a fair and logical move, or is this more a case of political strategy, as some government critics have argued?
No, I think it is a fair and expected move, one could say. It's been on the cards for a while, ever since... for many years, but last August, the Fair Work Act review was published, and many submissions to that review had argued for an extension of this right. It's also been extended in the United Kingdom and New Zealand and many countries around the world, so it's not unexpected in that sense. What is pleasing, I suppose, is that it's now back on the policy agenda as an issue that needs to be discussed.
Interesting you mentioned the UK, because of course in the UK, yes, it's in place, but you also have the right to appeal if your employer knocks back a request for a flexible working arrangement. We don't have that here.
No, we don't, and that's been another element of concern. And it has all, and that aspect actually was also one of the most frequent issues raised by those who made submissions to the Fair Work Act review, that there is no appeal mechanism for this particular right under the National Employment Standards, which makes it rather unique that it's in this area where it's primarily women who do request changes in their work arrangements, that there's no mechanism to appeal that.
So this has been in place for 2 years, at least for one category of worker, so parents of very small children, preschool age, or children under the age of 18 with a disability.
Yes.
Do we have any sense of the uptake?
We do have some sense of uptake, and the uptake tends to be amongst women more than men, as I just said. But interestingly, some research done by my colleague Barbara Pocock in South Australia has shown that there's also been a drop-off in the number of people formally requesting. So this may indicate, though, that it has become embedded in workplace cultures and it's been accepted, and there's a number of other reasons, and clearly more research is needed in the area. I'd like to also come to something Peter Strong said, which is interesting, I think, and this often is mentioned, that right has always been there. And what we're talking about there, I think, to clarify for the listeners, is that there's a difference between a formal right, one that exists in legislation and sort of makes it acceptable for the community to know that you're entitled to request flexible work arrangements, and what might be called an informal right, or just sort of, yes, anyone can ask their boss for anything, but you need backing usually to do that. And so we don't know how many people actually across the whole workforce would like to make these requests and just never do, because they know that the workplace culture or the reaction from their supervisor will be a negative one. And there's a substantial amount of research that suggests that is the case.
Yes, indeed. We'll come to you further on that,
sure.
And also to James Thompson in just a tick. But Marion, employers can at present refuse a request,
yes,
or decline a request is,
yeah,
probably a nicer way of putting,
yes,
it, in some workplaces, on reasonable grounds. What constitutes reasonable grounds here?
Well, these are reasonable business grounds, and so these are grounds that need to they're not specified, so one has to sort of think about the business arrangements and the business needs, and these might go to customer flows, to the product market at the time, to needs to be open for particular times, inability of an employer to substitute you in that work. I mean, there are a range, and employers can consider, well, what is the reasonable business ground that's particular to their business?
Yes, indeed.
And put that forward. But, of course, the data on this is not collected because they are not submitted to anywhere, these requests. And so they're all held within and between employers and employees. And that has made it hard for researchers to untangle this
further. Data
that's
is
right.
Everything. 1300 225 76, or 1300-CALL-RN is the number to call. And in fact, I'm having trouble logging into our text message screen, so probably don't text, ring 1300-CALL-RN. Have you put a request to your boss for flexible working arrangements because you have some needs at home that you need to manage, caring needs, caring responsibilities? How'd you go with that? Or if you're an employer, do you regularly field requests for flexible work arrangements, and how do you navigate that? How do you balance your needs as an employer with the needs of your employees? James Thompson, editor of BRW, Business Review Weekly. James, has there been feedback from employers on these right to request arrangements since they've been in place in the way that they have for about 2 years now? Can we generalise here?
Yeah, I think generally there's probably been a lack of feedback, and that perhaps suggests that the system's working quite well.
Do you think feedback doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the system?
Well, small businesses are small business owners particularly are very busy people, and when they find an issue that upsets them, they tend to be vocal on it. When things are going pretty well. My sense is that they tend to get on with running their business. Mm. The Prime Minister said that 80% of these requests have been resolved satisfactorily. It's a bit unclear.
I wonder where she got that figure.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. But to take that at face value, that suggests that the system's working pretty well. The other thing I would say is that small businesses have to compete for talent in what is a very difficult market. Often being able to pay more isn't within their grasp, so being able to offer flexible working arrangements is one tool they have to attract and retain good staff. So I think perhaps in the small business community, there's a bit of a meeting of a couple of forces here. The rights enshrined under the Fair Work Act is one side, but on the other side is a changing labour market where flexible work is something that most employers need to offer in some form to retain their best staff.
I just wonder if we don't have the data, how do we know that it's working very well? I just want to read a couple of Facebook comments we've got. One listener has said, I asked, as a single mum, registered nurse, I proposed in writing, citing workplace acts, laws, etc. It took 8 months for my employer to read it. When I asked in person, he said, if you want an answer right now, I'll bloody well give you one. I worked 12-hour days and was on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 10 months before I resigned due to massive stress. I will never work in that field again, which is a shame because my specialisation is alcohol and other substances in Indigenous and remote health. So there's an example of someone who found it very hard to negotiate this in their workplace. And we've had a couple more in that vein. Actually, interesting, all from the healthcare sector. James.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether there are specific circumstances in health that makes granting these flexible arrangements more difficult. I mean, Marion sort of hit the nail on the head when she said there's a lot of different business reasons that have to be considered, and the ability for people to make sure rosters are filled, the location of the work's important. It's a bit hard to offer flexible working arrangements like working from home in a manufacturing business, for example, because the plant and equipment's all in one place. There will be specific circumstances in specific businesses, and I think most employers certainly aren't waiting 8 months to return to respond to these requirements. I think you need to be a lot prompter than that to let your employee know where they stand.
And that's the purpose of legislation. Marion, you want to pick up on that?
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, that 8 months is actually totally unlawful, 8 to 10 months. Employers are required to reply.
28 days, isn't it?
21 days, I think it is. Yeah, so we do know there is that mechanism there that employers are required to reply in writing. But the Prime Minister and I think the Minister for Workplace Relations has also endorsed this, that the extension would also require a meeting of the employer and employee. And, that makes good business sense and good human resource management sense that you actually do sit down and talk about it as well. The next step would be to have some sort of enforcement procedure and appeal, which is lacking.
And that's what we'll come to. Let's come to a call. Kathy in Melbourne, you're a small business employer. Tell us about how you've gone with granting flexible hours.
Basically, we have staff. We've taken 5 years to actually get a really great team of people together. And I think when you run a business, it's got to be almost like a business family. So we basically know what's happening within our employees' lives, and they're a bit more like friends. So we would be... We would grant what they want because we want to keep them. They're great staff. We've put a lot of time into them and money to train them. And so because we have a good working relationship, we know they're not going to abuse that either. We know they're going to be, like, honest about it.
That can be tricky, though, can't it?
Kathy,
because, you have to balance your business needs with the relationship, good relationship you want to cultivate with your staff. Yep. Sometimes they are going to be at odds with each other.
Oh, look, absolutely. And there's always that cost factor where you're thinking, well, if they're not going to be working now, we've got to employ another person in the mix, or someone else has got to work longer, or, to replace that, because, there's always got to be someone on the floor. So it is tricky. And sometimes what we have to do is come to try to get a win-win where we say, well, look, we may not be able to do exactly this, but how about this? You know that compromise?
Yeah, we're coming,
so they know
meeting halfway.
We're trying as well.
Kathy, great call. Thank you very much for taking the time to ring us today.
Thank you.
Marion, do you have a comment on that?
Well, yes, I think Kathy's really gone to the heart of the issue, that the employment relationship is not necessarily going to be win-win all the time, and there will be differences of opinion, and so we need to work out ways to resolve that. And the second thing is that there is enormous fluidity now in people's working lives and in business, and yes, it might complicate the business scene, but it's a reality as well.
James Thompson, I wonder if the size of the workplace makes all the difference here sometimes. I mean, it really, again, it's horses for courses, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, small workplaces, I guess, get the swing and roundabout. There's not going to be too many requests because you don't have too many staff. But when there is a request, you are really going to have to make some compromises and make some, put the hard work in to make a flexible working arrangement work. And I think the call has just, given a great example of how these things are quite fluid in that, people's arrangements will change week to week. And perhaps even day to day. So good employers will keep the lines of communication open, and there will be some, give and take in that relationship that suits both parties.
We're talking about the extension of flexible, the right to request flexible arrangements at work being extended to many more of us, as the federal government has announced. What do you think of that? Have you attempted to negotiate flexible work arrangements with your employer? How have you gone? 1300 22 55 76 or 1300 call RN. Love to hear from employers who really have the challenge of working through these issues with their staff, big workplaces and little workplaces. Ellen in Canberra, you're the parent of a disabled child. You requested flexible hours.
Yeah.
How'd you go?
Well, I put through a request by email to my boss, and he took it that I was demanding extra special hours. My daughter had gone to a new school and there wasn't after-school care provided. So I put through that request and I ended up in some very heated debates with him where he was basically verbally abusing me. Ended up in almost a disciplinary meeting between him and the CEO, and nothing was resolved. So I ended up leaving and going to a different workplace.
And were you able to negotiate those arrangements with the next workplace?
Yes. Well, when different hours, different needs of my child come up, I'm always able to go and talk about it, and something might be put in place for 6 weeks, then we'll review it and see how it's going.
Okay.
So, yes, I am able to in that situation.
Thank you very much for the call and appreciate your input. Thanks, Caroline.
Thanks very much.
Alexandra in New South Wales, you're disturbed that over 55s will be included in this change in the legislation. Why? Hello, have we got you?
Oh,
hello, Alexander. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, you'd like to make a comment on the extension of this right to request to more of us, particularly those over 55.
Yes, it kind of moves the over 55s into a category or a problem category. And if you were looking to recruit anyone, you would openly discriminate against people in that age group because you don't want to put up with the hassle of it.
Oh, that's an interesting perspective, because couldn't it be viewed also as a realisation of the reality of our lives as we age, that we have more caring responsibilities and otherwise?
You mean on the part of the employee or the employer?
On the part of the employer.
I haven't seen that in evidence.
So you think it might be actually a method of discrimination. Alexander, thank you very much for that call.
You're welcome.
Marion, do you have any thoughts on that, that the opening up of this legislation to over 55s might problematise that generation of workers?
Look, it's a really interesting point, isn't it? My suggestion would be that we don't differentiate on the basis of age, but on the basis of caring responsibility. We did some research last year, which was very interesting in this particular issue, in large businesses actually. And what we found that, and we assumed it would be older people who had these additional caring responsibilities of your elder relatives, parents, aunts, uncles. We actually found a few that there were people who were less than 55, they may have been in their 40s, and they also had these quite difficult caring arrangements that they were trying to juggle. And I think probably the issue here is really one of care in the community. How do we as a whole society, try and balance this demand for more people in the workforce with a demand for increasing care in the community rather than in institutionalised care. So, you know, I suspect the 55 issue is one that we, in a policy sense, we should think about a bit more, and that it's the issue of caring that needs to be dealt with.
Let's come to another call. Caroline in New South Wales.
Good morning.
Hello there. Now, you're talking about job share because, of course, there are a whole range of ways we can request flexible working arrangements. We might want to go part-time, we might want to job share, we might want to come in later, leave later, or work a block of hours over a more compressed period of time. What have you managed to negotiate?
Well, I'm retired now, but I job shared for 10 years and it worked very well with good communication between the two people doing the same job. It resolves many an issue of part-time work and, or, you know, the flexibility. So I'd like to throw in very strongly the need for more job share situations.
That's great. Thank you for that point. And, of course, I know many people who have managed to really negotiate for themselves job share. Often it means partnering up with another colleague and going, what do you think, and taking a really seductive proposal to the boss. I mean, James Thompson, just coming to this question now of there being no formal right of appeal. If an employer says no to a request for flexibility, there's no independent umpire sizing up the reasons for the refusal. And Peter Strong of the Council of Small Business of Australia told Radio National last night that, in effect, he'll support any legislation that makes no difference. So he was concurring that this is, in effect, a kind of expansion that has no teeth. What do you make of that?
Look, I mean, I think the proposal put forward by the Prime Minister in the last few days is very vague. I mean, we're talking about over 55s. I don't think there's any detail like that around these proposals yet. The Prime Minister specifically mentioned mothers and fathers returning to the workforce after the birth of their child or the child's very early years, and they're already covered. So until we have some more detail, I think employers will be waiting and watching to see how this goes. The right of appeal is a vexed issue, I think. Where there's those sort of formal appeal processes is where the compliance burden, I guess, will increase for employers. But to come back to those stats quoted by the Prime Minister, I mean, 80% of these requests are settled satisfactorily. The need for that umpire or independent third party, you know, is arguably relatively limited.
It's hard to know, though, isn't it? Because if we don't know that, if we don't hear about those requests that are refused, how are we ever going to know? Marion Baird, I mean, also, if we think about workplace dynamics, realistically, even if there was a right to appeal, how many employees are actually going to take that up and make things uncomfortable in their workplace once their boss has already said no? Realistically, people in workplaces often don't do that because of the power dynamics.
Yeah, I mean, the power dynamics are very important here. But I do want to say just something else, that at the moment we understand that the acceptance of this right to request is quite high. If we broaden it and understand the shifts in what's happening in workplaces, more people who may not be culturally as accepted within workplaces could request. And I'm thinking here particularly of men. There's a big shift to occur. And we know from the UK data and research that's been done that they are more likely to have their request refused. And so this goes to other issues that are going on. Most of our research has shown that returning to work from maternity leave has been accepted. It's become a norm in the workplace to return in flexible or part-time arrangements. But to return as a father is different. To be 57 and request flexible workplace arrangements is a different situation. And that is going to generate some greater debate within workplaces.
James, is that something that you've been documenting over the years as well, the shift in what men want in terms of flexibility at work?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's a range of particularly men in the latter stages of their career are often leaving full-time work and moving on to a sort of consulting or part-time role or even a sort of official mentoring capacity within a business. So I think those shifts are already happening. And I guess the question is how far we need to go to enshrine that. But I think employers are cognizant that people's requirements are changing, and I think the labour market's changing to suit that.
I just want to briefly squeeze in, James. The PM has also talked about protections for workers whose rosters change. Mm. For example, rosters changing at short notice. How would employers react to that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's a bit hard, you know, it'll be very, very specific with that question. You know, why did the roster change? Is it a permanent change or a temporary change? You know, do we need to get people, more people in to handle a rush job, or is it a more permanent shift?
It's a big issue for employees, rosters changing on a whim, very hard to cobble together casual workloads over time.
And I think that's the point. You know, employers need to be better at communicating those changes.
Yes, indeed. Let's take one quick last call. Katrina, thank you for joining us. Now, you'd like to make a strong point here.
Yeah, I think that the discussion is focused on people who are in stable employment and who have a good relationship with their employer. And if you're a job seeker or a person who has a flexible arrangement and is seeking to change roles, it's near impossible to find meaningful and well-paid professional work that affords flexibility. My personal example is that I went for a management position in the digital industry and the employer said, look, we just can't pay you the salary that you're asking for. And I said, well, what's probably more important to me than the extra few grand is some flexibility. So the ability to work 8 till 4, which as you'll realise is still a full business day, just shift it back by an hour. And they said, we're sorry, our studio's open till 6 p.m. and we have that expectation of all employees. So in other words, you're a shirker because you've asked for some flexibility, not even reduction in hours, and I didn't get the position.
Thank you very much, Katrina, for that. Another example of how difficult this can be in individual workplaces. Just want to quickly read another Facebook comment. I've done it with no problem. My child's shared care arrangement meant I needed to start late some days, but could start super early others and make up hours later that day or finish early to pick up said child. As long as employers can facilitate this without paying any penalty rates, it was to my benefit. I think it's a great thing. So a full diversity of experiences. Let's thank James Thompson, editor of BRW. Thanks, James.
Thank you for having me.
Terrific to have you. Marion Baird, Professor of Employment Relations at the Business School at the Sydney University. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Keep the conversation going on our Facebook page as you have. Get on that or 0283 1430 if you'd like to leave a message. 0283 1430 if you'd like to leave your thoughts. Coming up, we're heading to the streets to dance.
Coming up on The Law Report, meet Melbourne father Andy Corp, whose daughter Elsa Corp was murdered by a man out on parole. In the throes of grief, Andy was shocked to discover that in the weeks leading up to Elsa's death, her murderer had been arrested 3 times, but his parole never cancelled. Well, last week, in response to Andy Corp's campaign, the Victorian government tightened the rules around parole. That's coming up on The Law Report with me, Damien Carrick, here on RN this afternoon at 5:30.
Look, back in 1998, Eve Ensler, famous for her play The Vagina Monologue, started V-Day. That's Valentine's Day, yes, but it's also Vagina Day. It's Victory Over Violence Day, and in case you didn't know, it's coming up this Thursday. And on V-Day this week, don't be surprised if you witness a sudden breakout of women dancing in the street. You can join them too, by the way. People are coming together in 197 countries for 1 billion rising. That's what it's called. And to find out more about what it is, I'm joined now by Jane Brock. She's Executive Officer of the Immigrant Women's Speak Out Association and an organiser, one of many organisers for 1 billion rising. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you very much, Natasha.
Lovely to have you here. And also joining us is Nicole Blewett-Boyd. She's a researcher at the Australian Institute of Family Studies, the Australian Institute of Family Studies Centre for the Study of Sexual Assault. And she's going to talk to some research that is just out about how violence is shifting to the digital domain. Nicole, thanks for joining us. I'll come to you in a moment.
Thank you.
Jane, what are women being asked to do worldwide on V-Day this Thursday? Describe what's going to happen.
Well, first of all, in Western Sydney, we will have a flash mob dance, and we have invited schools in particular the Arthur Phillip High School, which is close to the Parramatta Town Hall. So there will be 50 high school students who will be coming. There will be community workers, government staff members, as well as some community leaders.
So just to describe, this is one example of what will be happening in 197 countries across the world. But a flash mob is where you all land in a public space and you dance. Why yes. dancing against violence?
Well, dancing is a form of, it is an expression that we usually love to do, and we can dance to show rage, we can dance to show happiness, we can dance to show many, many emotions. But at this time, we'd like everybody to enjoy the moment of coming together as a community and saying no to violence against women. That's now, what it is.
What is significant here is in many parts of the world, women, that they have no chance of dancing in the streets as part of this action, 1 billion rising, do they? In some parts of the world, to dance publicly, to even present themselves publicly en masse like this, is a risk to their life. Where in particular?
It will be done in other forms. For example, there will be poetry reading. And in those places like Afghanistan, in countries like Afghanistan, and also countries like Bangladesh, where you have acid throwing, and this type of practice, the acid throwing on faces of women who assert the right to safety, to right to decide their own destiny and not be forced to marry somebody, or even, paying dowry, and all of these harmful practices. They are, they have to do it in a way that they will not compromise their safety on that day.
That's the critical thing, isn't it? Because the irony is this is what the protest is about, an affirmative protest. So, but women in Afghanistan are going to gather, aren't they?
Yes, they will. And that we will have to watch out, because we don't know yet what exactly they will be doing. Because as you know, even here in Sydney, when we have the Afghan women having their Mother's Day, they can dance inside a community hall, but all should be women. Mm. They cannot be a man.
In the company
inside.
Of men.
Yeah, in the company of men.
What about India? Because, of course, in India, violence against women has become an incredibly heated and emotive issue in recent weeks because of that dreadful gang rape on a bus of the young medical student and her subsequent death. And, of course, the kind of campaigns against widespread rape in India. What are they going to be doing?
Well, of course, they know the danger of
big population
out,
of women,
of course, yeah. and we are expecting, I believe, thousands of them will come out. And Indian women and the Indian community loves Bollywood dancing; that's part of the culture. So I guess it will be acceptable for many members of the community out there in India. But still, after the event, they have to watch out for their back. And they have asked the police and also other security forces to be there during the flash mob dance, and
it's
even after.
Very sobering to be reminded that any public representation like this can put many women in the world at great danger of their lives, and the repercussions might be felt some weeks after. Look, just coming to where you work in Western Sydney, I mean, a very diverse community, high immigrant population. Violence happens in every community, regardless of race, class, life experience. It's there for all women in every sphere. But what are some of the particular issues that you deal with?
Well, first of all, the marriage migrants. Marriage migrants in Australia have to wait for 2 years before they become permanent resident, before they can reapply to become permanent resident. And the 2 years is a time that's very crucial, especially for those who do not know about the law, the legal system in Australia, in particular, the law on family and domestic violence. And even in workplaces, the cases of women who are on marriage migrant situation and who have the temporary residence mark on their passport, when employers see this, there has been actually report that employers actually have committed sexual harassment and bullying towards these women just because of that mark of being temporary resident. So that's one. And of course, the other are the refugee women who have come here. They experience this transition in their lives where, you know, women have started working. And of course, you know, that make a lot of difference in terms of balance of authority. When in their country of origin, it's always the male.
Yes, which can make things very tense in families, can't it?
Yes.
And that's sometimes that tension can be a trigger for violence.
Exactly.
So 1 Billion Rising happening this Thursday, and we'll put information on the Life Matters website about how people can participate. Wherever you are in the world, rise up. I want to come now to Nicole Blewett-Boyd, who's doing some incredibly interesting work, just released, in fact, about how violence doesn't just manifest in the physical world and upon us physically, but also about how the instruments of technology, like mobile phones, like the internet, can actually facilitate violence in different ways now. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What have you actually been looking at?
Well, this was an 18-month study that involved interviews with professionals working in the legal, educational, academic, policy and counselling sectors concerning the issue of technology and experiences of sexual violence. Initially, we wanted to know whether the legal framework adequately addressed sexual offending that involves the use of technology, such as social networking and mobile phones. We focused our research on young people aged 12 to 26 as an age group that tended to use these technologies. And also recognising that young people, particularly young women, comprise an at-risk demographic in relation to sexual violence. So we looked at both adult-to-child offending and peer-to-peer offending. And we found ultimately that the challenge presented by social networking mediums and sexual violence is not primarily a legal one. Importantly, our participants related that new technologies themselves do not cause sexual violence.
Oh, that's interesting. But it facilitates it. How?
Absolutely. There are a number of aspects of the offending that were enhanced or created through the use of new technology. So key aspects included the increased speed and progression of the grooming process, facilitated in particular by the internet as a relatively unpoliced space, and the often false sense of anonymity and detachment of victims created by the use of technology.
So this is things like friending people on Facebook and starting a kind of conversation, being all friendly, and that can lead on to other exchanges that are totally inappropriate.
Absolutely, and friending does create a sense of trust, and often false sense of trust, yeah.
And what can go wrong with it?
What can go wrong with it is that, you know, a lot of young people are exposed to people that they would never have otherwise met in the physical world. And it can lead to a range of different behaviours. And in fact, our research identified a spectrum of behaviours involving these technologies. It's important to note, too, that these behaviours can range from consensual to coercive and violent. But at the violent end of the spectrum, there are a number of ways that the new technology is used to coerce and abuse, and we understand this behaviour as occurring before, during and after an act of sexual violence. That's how we've categorised it.
Can you give us some examples?
Absolutely. So before acts of sexual violence, technologies increase accessibility to potential victims, as I mentioned before, and you spoke about the act of friending, for example. But participants also identified a method called blackmail grooming, and the crux of this conduct is the threat of distribution of imagery and information provided by the victim to coerce non-consensual activity. And look, given...
So this might have been information that was consensually provided initially, but then becomes an instrument of violence against them.
Absolutely. Consensually provided or coerced or pressured out of someone. I mean, we have that whole spectrum. But in terms of the threat to distribute, this is a very real threat to victims, given the nature of technology and how easy it is to distribute imagery and information.
I just wonder, though, we don't want to put people off using... I mean, social media can be a wonderful tool for connectivity between men and women, and it's not always a sort of basis of violence, is it? So, I mean, we have to kind of proceed with caution here as well. But it seems to be that this kind of grooming does is usually directed from men to women.
Absolutely. There's quite a gendered aspect to it. Even when we're talking about peer-to-peer interaction, our participants related to us that there's sort of broader gendered social scripts that influence this behaviour. So, for example, our participants told us that young women in particular are subject to forms of pressure and coercion that young men often are not. And this is in the case of, for example, activities such as requesting or disseminating naked imagery.
I just want to come back to Jane Brock, spokesperson for the 1 Billion Rising project, which is happening on Thursday, Valentine's Day, as it turns out. She's also the executive officer for the Immigrant Women's Speak Out Association in Western Sydney. Jane, thinking about what Nicole's saying, about we hear about, as you said, the acid attacks on women in Bangladesh, the threats to women's lives in Afghanistan. Is technology, is the internet facilitating different kinds of violence in some of these communities?
Definitely. Proven already by the trafficking in women and children, we know that a lot of traffickers use the internet to lure women and their families to go into this type of dealings, and most often they are the kind of dealings that is connected with money and getting the family indebted and also paying a lot of money to the people who are the recruiters. And they tell them that there is work in this country, but when they arrived here, they go straight to the brothel.
Yes. Look, we've just opened the lid on a huge issue here, and we've run out of time. But Nicole, I'm going to put a link to, we'll put a link to your report on the Life Matters website, because you offer some very interesting solutions and perspectives on education around this issue. Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you very much.
Nicole Blewett-Boyd, a researcher at the Australian Institute of Family Studies Centre for the Study of Sexual Assault, and also Jane Brock, Executive Officer of the Immigrant Women's Speak Out Association in Western Sydney. 1 Billion Rising, we'll put a link to the Facebook page. That's where people should go, yes?
Thank you. Yes, that's where it will go.
Okay,
yes.
Terrific. We'll put a link to the 1 Billion Rising website. In fact, our own Prime Minister has put a video up there about why you should get involved this Thursday. 1 Billion Rising, a global dance against violence against women. Well, we're turning to breakfast cereal next, of all things, coming up on RN.
It's a global trend where people are gathering and analysing their own data about their health and fitness. It's known as self-tracking, body hacking, or
cyberchondria. Hyperchondria facilitated by the use of internet.
Right now, the quantified self movement is a glimpse into the future of healthcare.
When you're tracking yourself, you're providing yourself a service a doctor can't do. They just don't have the time.
The Body Sphere. Download or stream it from the RN website.
I'm wondering,
what is the best way?
Have you ever...
Is that how?
Hey, how about that? Well, this is how.
I've never thought of that.
It's not something I'd ever think of.
It's purely practical.
Breakfast. The most important meal of the day, so we're told, but when it comes to breakfast cereals, especially for children, you know, colourful packaging can trump nutritional value, it seems to me. Is anything in them any good for us and our kids? So to get purely practical about what to look for and what to avoid in a breakfast cereal, I'm joined now by nutritionist Catherine Saxelby, who has raced into the studio for us. Thank you so much, Catherine.
You're very welcome, Natasha.
Sometimes the changing of guards is quick. Look, why do nutritionists make the case for breakfast being the most important meal of the day? Is there good evidence for that?
Oh, look, I think breakfast is one of the most researched meals. We've got more research on breakfast, which dates back to the 50s, than on lunch or dinner or snacks. So I think they've recognised that we are breaking the fast, which is where the word comes from. You're breaking the overnight fast because most people haven't had anything to eat for 8 or 10 hours. And I find children particularly need something in their stomach, especially if you want them to concentrate in those morning classroom lessons. Dieters also need something because the research again shows that having a breakfast, usually a healthy breakfast, seems to set you up for the whole day, stops you picking and snacking on pastries or chips or pizza at 11 o'clock.
Yes, going for that kind of sweet thing for morning tea.
So a healthy breakfast high in fibre, you know, filling, something nutritious is actually very important if you're trying to control your weight. Now, a lot of dieters don't like having breakfast in the morning.
Yes, now but that's counterproductive, isn't it, in terms of their metabolic race?
Is
that right?
We seem to burn off more calories or kilojoules in the morning and less in the afternoon. But also when I talk to people on diets, often they've had a meal quite late at night. I'm saying probably 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. They're still not hungry in the morning. Or in that morning rush, you know, getting the kids off to school, getting breakfast, it's just the last thing on their mind. They just don't have time and they're not ready to eat.
So many options for breakfast.
Yes.
But you just said before, kids particularly need something in their tummies. Mm. If they're getting good food throughout the day, not very processed, lots of fresh fruit and veggies and, you know, dairy and good mix of food, does it really matter what they eat for breakfast if that's the only junk they're going to eat and they've been seduced by the really sugary, chocolatey kind of little bubbles of delight that the kids so often are in the shops?
Yeah. For a couple of comments. First of all, the sweetened cereals still have lots to recommend them. There's worse things than pre-sweetened cereals.
40% sugar in some of them, though.
Yeah. But they're pretty well all low in fat. They have got added vitamins and iron. There's 4B vitamins and iron. They're usually consumed with milk, so you get calcium and protein, and that lowers the glycemic index. And they're quick and easy. They're inexpensive, great for busy families in the morning. Having said that, children do need something on their stomach, so they can't go to school, sit through till 11 o'clock, till recess. And teachers often introduce the heavy going stuff in the morning, the maths, the things they want the kids to concentrate on. So you can't let your kid go out the door with nothing. If all they'll eat is a glass of milk, a glass of milk's fine. If they have some sweetened cereals, at least they're getting the milk and maybe a banana on top. It's not my ideal cereal, but they're a pretty good choice.
Yes, well, that's tricky, isn't it? So what about the rest? I don't know that that's a recipe for saying, yep, give them junk in the morning.
No, it isn't. And I know families, one of the great rules I thought families often have is to say to kids, during school term, you're having the healthier cereals, the high fibre, whole grain cereals, which is the ones I recommend. In holidays, you can have the pre-sweetens.
Okay, that's
a good start.
And then
that kind of controls it.
So let's turn over the cereal box, as I do, and you've brought some cereal boxes in. No brand names today, but negotiating that label of what's in them. So you say high fibre, low sugar, but the thing is you get a certain sort of serving size, which varies because that's not regulated.
No.
So where to start? Fibre.
Yes, I say go for a high fibre, and I have defined that as over 10%. So you'd look down the per 100 gram column, and I tell you these cereals are getting more complicated because they have per serve with milk, 100 grams, and then now the percentage of the recommended intake. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 columns.
Good luck with
that. It is hard. So look across the fibre, more than 10% fibre gets my vote. And things like the bran cereals are up at 30%. And things like the plainer pops and flakes are down at 2%. So 10's a nice ballpark figure where you'll get a lot of those high-fibre cereals.
10 grams per 100 grams. Serve, so that's 10%.
Yeah. Whole grain is another clue.
And are there particular words that are used to describe whole grain? Because, again, that can vary.
Oh, look, it does. And you've got to be very careful with whole grain because they can say wheat, but it's not whole wheat. So it's got to be whole barley, whole oats. Or a lot of them now have whole grain splashed on the front. I say more than 51% whole grain, they'll have the percentage of whole grain. So if it's just got 10% whole grain, well, that's not much. But more than 50% means more than half of the cereal that's gone into it, the raw oats or barley.
Pure
or
oats
rice.
Is the best, isn't it? 100% whole grain.
It is. It is 100% whole grain, or some of the wheat biscuits are 97% whole grain.
I can see all the kids going groan. Yeah. So far you've said high fibre, whole grain, but sometimes it's about getting kids into the habit early on. What about sugar? Because
yes.
Again, you know, what you've observed, I think, is that because the serving size on the back of the label, on the label is not regulated, people can sometimes bump up or reduce the serving size to make the sugars sound less and the fibre sound more.
Exactly.
So what about sugar then? Because
I don't want sugary cereals, but I find sometimes you just want a little bit of sweetness. Now, you can add dried fruit or a banana or some stewed apple, but the guidelines that most nutritionists recommend is look for one with less than 15% sugars, and it's sugars, plural, because that on the label includes both added and natural. Or if there's a cereal that has sultanas or raisins or cranberries in it, less than 25%.
So you're allowing for the natural sugars in those
that's
fruits.
That's right.
And still, that bumps up your sugar intake.
A little bit, but it's not excessive. It's a moderate amount of sugar, which is quite nutritionally acceptable. Now,
so just remind me again, because that's always been one that I've gone, well, what percentage of sugar? I mean, like, how am I meant to work out what amount of sugar I'm meant to have in a cereal?
It's impossible.
And how
label.
Does that relate to the rest of my day's intake? You know,
well,
so you're
need,
saying,
Natasha,
did you
need
say
to
15%?
Yeah, 15%
sugars. Less than 15% sugars, plural.
Yeah, and there's plenty of them. I've just been in the supermarket and there's lots of brands that are less than 15%. There's even more, less than 25. Over 25, then you're getting into the pre-sweetened kiddie pop cereals that, that we don't want kids to eat. Or we only want them to have it when they're out as a treat. I think they need to see those as a treat and the other plainer, whole grain, high fibre ones as their regular fare. But a lot of people also add honey or sugar to their plain cereals.
I was going
to
say that.
And I've been doing the mathematics and crunching the numbers, and often it's about the same or even more. You end up a tablespoon of honey on 3 wheat flake biscuits in the morning is more sugar than from a bowl of pre-sweetened.
But you're getting more fibre. So
you're getting
then
more fibre.
That's
more
pale.
Filling.
Now, people wouldn't necessarily think of salt. Salt is hidden in many, many foods.
It's interesting, isn't
it? We forget about
it?
That flavour, that sort of subliminal saltiness. But what about salt?
Well, it's interesting. The cereal companies have been very quietly lowering the sodium or the salt content of their cereals over the past 5 years. As a group, they've all been trying to get our salt intake down. So now I say less than 400 milligrams of sodium per 100 grams.
And what are you basing these figures on? Is this what evidence are you drawing together to say, look, for breakfast, this is how much salt and sugar can get away with, how much fibre is optimum?
Yes, exactly. So if you want a yardstick, the government regulation for a low-salt food is less than 120. Not many cereals except for plain
120
oats.
120 what?
Just 120 milligrams per 100 grams. Sorry, yep. I keep forgetting. Cereals used to be up around 700, 800, 900, even 1,000 milligrams.
Wow.
Because I have books that I've written 10, 15 years ago, and I can see the figures I quoted then, and I would have got them from the back of the packs. Now, most companies are getting them under 600 milligrams, and we're trying to push them down to 400 milligrams. If you look at things like the Heart Foundation, TIC, they have their criteria, and they're also trying to push companies to reduce the salt down to 400. So I'm using...
And that's an authentic TIC. That TIC isn't appearing on cereals that you would think, oh, no.
No.
That is appearing on the better range of cereals.
Yeah, and there's cereals that the Heart Foundation analyses, and they have a secret shopper as well. So a couple of times a year they go and check on them all, have them analysed. So I think we can be pretty sure that tick's got some analysis and work done behind it.
Just finally, your favourite, and it's mine too.
My favourite.
Muesli.
I went and I bought some.
Oh, you've just got the most boring looking muesli.
Look, I got... A typical muesli. Now, this is a premium. It was a bit more expensive. But
not
I
toasted,
find...
But full of fruit, full
I
of
find,
bran, full
no,
of raw
I
oats.
Find I have to add seeds and nuts to every muesli on the market. And this is mine. So that's the before and this is the after. And I've added sunflower seeds, prunes, bran, bits of bran, pistachios and coconut strands. And I think... I think mine's a lot better.
Looking so good to me. Oh, thank you very much. Catherine's muesli, with just freshly made too. I'm going to enjoy that. In fact, I know a lot of people who do that too. They kind of make up their own concoction.
You can make your own from scratch, but if I'm busy, I'll grab a packet, but I just add whatever I've got in the cupboard.
We're going to link to a little analysis that you've put together on the basis of your appraisal from the Life Matters website. So we'll link to Catherine Saxelby's website. Thank you for coming in. Thanks for your concoction of muesli.
Well, we could do a whole topic on muesli.
We could,
and porridge and oats.
Oh, yeah. Porridge. Yes, indeed. Delicious. Grated apple. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks,
Natasha. Nutritionist Catherine Saxelby. We'll pop more details on the Life Matters website. That's our purely practical for this week. Over to the wonderful Daniel Browning, who is coming up with Books and Arts. Good morning.
Good morning, Natasha. We've got Amit Chowdhury, the Indian writer.
Special.
And he's going to kind of meditate on kind of the history and the kind of politics of West Bengal and Calcutta in his latest book.
Rich indeed. Thanks, Daniel. Have a great show.
Worries.
That's straight after the news. Look, next on Life Matters, why aren't there more male childcare workers in childcare centres? We're going to look right into that issue. Coming up to the news, 10 a.m. on RN. Bye from me.
On the Health Report, infant morality.
I'm interested in how we know what things are good and bad and what things are right and wrong and which individuals are the good guys and which are the bad guys. And asking that question in babies before they can speak, before they've been to school, before their parents have really taught them much about what's good and bad, and ask whether they already know.
Plus a lot more about your nervous system, including what juggling does for your brain. That's with me, Norman Swan. Why not download this Health Report podcast from RN's website?